afternoon. Welcome to We the People. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us, Bill?
Well, we
can
have,
I heckle you today? Let's get that out right away. Are you up for that?
No.
You just did it, though, so
I know it. Yeah, our major sponsor this hour is Pape. Yeah, their major sponsor is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, right between Oasis and Pine Grove exits. Go up and see them if you need anything John Deere. You need a tractor fixed or a mower fixed. They can do it all up there, full parts, sales, and service. Or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at PapeMachinery.com.
So for all you What's Up Doc fans, can you fix a hi-fi?
You can fix a hi-fi, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's a good thing we got cured from the Rona, because we got back just in time for the truck convoy and the war. Good grief, there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
And try to fix Bill's headset. Hold on. Apparently, I can't do more than one thing. I'm like Curly on City Slickers. I'm doing my one thing. Holy cow. So we thought that it would make perfect sense to have Dr. Peter Vincent Pry back on again today, because he knows about all this stuff. And I don't know about you, but I'm a little tired of watching the same 14 seconds of video clip and the same talking heads all say the same thing for an entire week and tell me basically nothing.
Yeah. I watched a video yesterday morning of a truck that got shot up. And just before I went to bed, they were still showing the same video. So
obviously, we're on the radio, so we're not gonna tantalize you with video. But bottom line is, the information just is not all that current, and they're not giving any historical perspective, which would be nice to have every now and then. Just as a point of fact, you can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us, and we have archives going back to 2010, I think, because we're old. So the older we get, the longer we can do this. But the archives are commercial free. They are all long form interviews. At the beginning, we were only an hour, and then at some point, we switched to 2 hours. And I typically like to have the same guest on for the whole time, so we learned something.
Yeah, we just couldn't shut up. We need another hour to get it all out.
Well, the good news is we don't do all the talking. Our phone number and email and all that is on the website if you need to contact us, or if you know somebody who you think we should interview. We do authors, other people who have other talk shows, whoever you think is interesting and you'd like to hear more from them instead of, you know, a minute and a half on some news interview. For those of you who haven't been with us, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He's also the director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both of those are congressional advisory boards. He served as chief of staff of the Congressional EMP Commission, in addition to being on the staffs of the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission and the House Armed Services Committee. He was an intelligence officer with the CIA, responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy. He has a PhD in history and archaeology, and he has another PhD in strategic studies, which is what led him to the CIA. He's the author of numerous books, including Will America Be Protected? That's 2022. Blackout Warfare in 2021, and The Power and the Light in 2020, and he's got a bunch of other ones. And last night, actually more like this morning at 2:30, I updated all the books on the website for you. So you can just click on those and look at the list. It's not an exhaustive list of all his papers by any means, but you can learn quite a bit and get a pretty good perspective on what's going on. I had somebody ask me the other day about EMP, and Dr. Pry is obviously the expert on that. So the date today is February 27th, 2022, just in case we re-air this and the war in Ukraine has done something else, stopped, started.
Escalated.
Yeah, who knows? And I just want you to know that I put his article on here, The Doom of NATO, question mark. So I should have said The Doom of NATO. I'm not an uptalker, so it's kind of hard for me. But you can see he's got a couple of graphics on there if you do go to the website that will be helpful, I think, and instructive as far as the amount of weapons and those kinds of things. So, talking of blue streak there, my blue streak's over. Dr. Pry, it's all you.
Well, I enjoyed your blue streak.
He's all stunned.
I've never been more depressed, more concerned. learned. I don't know if you followed the, first of all, the fog of war, you know, covers this Ukrainian thing, and the press is reporting all kinds of things that we can't tell if they're true or not. The Ukrainian government and the U.S. government have, and the NATO governments all have interests in wanting to construct a narrative that's going to support all of their policy agendas, and as do the Russians. So what is true and what is false, you know, we can't really tell at this point. It is reported, you know, by Russian press, RT and Sputnik, and by the Russian government, that Putin is sitting in his nuclear bunker now and has put his nuclear forces on high alert. Not an exercise. That has rarely happened in history. There are unconfirmed reports that the U.S. nuclear forces have gone to DEFCON 2, which I find very hard to believe. We've never done that in history, not even during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I don't think the United States is capable of going to DEFCON 2 so quickly.
Now, what's DEFCON 2, Dr. Pryor?
Well, there's 5 readiness levels in our system. DEFCON 5 is the normal day-to-day readiness, which means, you know, the ICBMs are ready to launch in a few minutes. And we've got, a couple of ballistic missile submarines out at sea. It takes them longer to launch because they have to get emergency action messages. It can take them hours, but they're basically on patrol out there, and they'll launch as quickly as possible when they get messages. In DEFCON 2, you know, you're increasing the combat readiness. You're starting to mobilize forces, mobilize the bombers, getting the submarines ready to go to sea, all of them. At DEFCON 3, excuse me, yeah, that's right, DEFCON 3, you're at a still higher readiness level where you're just about where the submarines are. You're increasing the number of boats that are out there on patrol, okay? And the bombers are still not ready to go at that point, but they're fueled up. You're loading up cruise missiles on them and the like. DEFCON 2, where we supposedly are, means that all your forces are within 6 hours of readiness to go to war. You know, so I don't see how that could be, because I think if we were submarines to sea and mobilizing the bomber forces, that couldn't be kept secret. You know, that would be known. There'd be so much activity happening. And DEFCON 1, basically, is you're at war. So that would mean that we're supposedly on the threshold. Now, you know, there was an official-looking thing going around the email that had a NATO shield on it that claimed that we were at DEFCON 2. I don't think we've moved off of DEFCON 5, personally. But who knows? You know, I think the Russians probably are at an increased level of readiness. Some of the reporting on that is that they're at the highest level of readiness, and I don't believe that, because that means all of their submarines would be at sea. And although you can do it with the ICBMs, I mean, most of the Russian forces most of their warheads are in ICBMs, which are always ready to go. They can be launched in about 3.5 minutes when they get after getting the authorization code. And, and Putin is supposedly in the deep underground command post. I don't want to dwell on that. And I'm not even raising that as an example of the fog of war thing. It's probably true that the Russian nuclear forces are in an increased state of readiness. They just had an exercise, before this, a supposed exercise, that was probably used to raise the readiness of their nuclear forces clandestinely. And now they're announcing that, yeah, they did raise the readiness of their forces. There was reporting before that. But I don't want to get bogged down in the technical issues. Mm-hmm. Just as long as we're on it, though, to make a liar of myself, to a little more technical issue, we have 5 readiness levels. The Russians have got 4 readiness levels. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a constant combat readiness, which is the level they're on all the time. You know, where the ICBMs are always ready to go. And they've got a couple of submarines at sea that are ready to go. And then there's increased combat readiness, you know, where the ICBMs raise their readiness level. Now, this means that you're putting all the mobile ICBMs out. You know, they're all, usually they have some of them deployed, but not all of them. And they're putting all of that mobile ICBMs out, in addition to the silo-based ICBMs that are ready. And they're starting to get their bombers ready to go, and starting to get submarines ready to go. They can raise the readiness of their submarines faster than we can, because their submarines carry ICBMs, not intermediate-range ballistic missiles. They can hit us launching from their ports. And so this means they've turned on the command control systems necessary to launch those submarines from port if that becomes necessary at increased combat readiness. Then at threat of war readiness, everything is ready, pretty much ready to go and mobilized. Then at full combat readiness, you're at war. And there's a reason why the Russians have four levels of readiness and we have five. Because they know that we have five readiness levels, and they've always tried to achieve a first strike. They always try to mobilize their forces, you know, to get inside of our readiness cycle. But anyway, this whole Ukrainian thing, even the fact that we're just talking about nuclear war now, okay, all right, you know, I've been writing about this. This is one of the things I was very concerned with, that this could escalate out of control. The possibility of something like this happening over Ukraine, in which the United States has no vital strategic interest. I'm just hoping that the worst is not going to happen and that a lot of this is untrue. What I really like to say, if I get across nothing else, I mean, there's so much to say, and we have hours to say it, okay?
Thank goodness.
But one thing I want to hit very hard, very hard. You know, because I'm sure you're not going to hear this from anywhere else. You know, the thing that appalls me most of all about all of this news coverage and everything is, you know, is the press, the Republican Party, everybody who should be looking at this within, all the press narrative appears to be designed to hope or distract people from noticing that President Biden has basically destroyed U.S. superpower credibility and possibly changed the world order so the U.S. is not really, that the world order has changed, that the post-1945 world order that has been based, underwritten by U.S. security guarantees and based on the credibility of the United States, has basically been destroyed by this guy in a day. And why do I say that? Because Biden put America's credibility all on the line. He staked it all on the line, drew a line in the sand over Ukraine, and Russian tanks rolled right over it. And now, his response to this is the incredibly weak response of economic sanctions and fighting to the last brave Ukrainian, you know, by giving them arms while we stand back. Now, if you're a country that's depending upon the United States for your security, and you've seen this happen, it's got to be the final blow, you know, to the credibility of the United States as your global policeman, as the guy that's going to be relied upon to come to your rescue. It's understandable that the press would cover for Biden, or maybe they're just too stupid to actually notice it, and they follow the narrative that comes out of the White House, because the narrative that's coming out of the White House is focused on the brave Ukrainians and, oh, see the trouble the Russians are getting bogged down. and this kind of a narrative, because they're hoping, what the Biden White House is hoping, is that if the Russian invasion of Ukraine doesn't go so well, or even fails, that that'll get Biden off the hook.
Yeah, because he'll be the genius who saved the world.
Yeah, that he'll have backed them off, that will have worked, and his credibility and our credibility remains intact. But it doesn't remain intact. You know, he won't have done anything to make that outcome, except providing, you know, arms to Ukraine. But that's not the thing that will really have.
No. Hold on for two seconds.
I have to. What? Do we have a break coming up?
Yeah, we have a little break here.
This is terrible because I don't want to leave people with the impression that the Russians are bogged down. But I want to get to that when
we let's pick that.
We will pick that up immediately on the backside of this. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing.
You ever love someone? It was so hip to knock the USA. It was so awful and we're so bad. You ought to check the nightlife and live in Grad. It ain't even close. It's better in the USA.
It's better in the USA.
You can see behind the curtain. Life is cold and gray.
It's better in the USA.
How can I make you understand?
Didn't like the end of the song there, Travis? You're on Uber Fade? Very odd. All right, Dr. Pry, can you pick up where
we were talking about the supposed bog down?
Yeah, I didn't want to leave your listeners with the false impression that the Russians are bogged down in Ukraine. That's exactly what the left-wing mainstream media and all of the world in the West, by which I mean the countries allied with the United States, want people to believe. That's part of the narrative. Part of that is to try to rescue Joe Biden, you know, from the humiliation of having destroyed U.S. strategic credibility, you know, put up this tremendous bluff in his eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation with Putin, to Putin, called his bluff and sent the tanks in. And now, you know, there's this desperate game. I think it's a game, or maybe it's just self-delusion, who knows, you know, to try to make it look as bad as possible for the Russians, you know, hoping that that will distract people from what happened. Because it doesn't matter whether the Russians succeed in conquering Ukraine or not. That will be all due to the Ukrainians, not anything the United States has done. Maybe a little bit, because of the arms supplies and the rest. But addressing this issue, are the Russians bogged down? Are they bogging down? It's only been
4 days.
Right. They're already on the outskirts of Kiev. They've only used a third of the forces that they mobilized, you know, to do that. And Ukraine and Putin is doing this because he wants to incorporate Ukraine into Russia again. He considers it part of Russia. So he has all kinds of interests to do this in a surgical way, not as if Ukraine is a NATO member that he just wants to flatten and destroy completely. You know, he wants these people to become loyal to Russia. You know, he needs their population because Russia has got a population problem, as well as just wanting them to become loyal to Russia. And so he has every interest in trying to do this surgically, and that's going to take more time. But given all of that, the fact that they're on the verge of capturing Kiev, you know, in 4 or 5 days, they've been on the outskirts of Kiev for quite a while, and the other major cities as well. You know, they're on their outskirts as well. By way of comparison, you know, when Nazi Germany conquered France in 1940, it did it in 40 days. And that's what was considered a lightning war. It's considered sort of the classic model of an incredibly fast conquest of a country. Ukraine is about the size of France. And, you know, so the Russians are really, assuming the worst reporting or the best reporting from the Ukrainian perspective, the Russians don't look to me like they're doing so bad, despite all this talk about bogging down and everything. Another thing is the Russians have got a vast air superiority that if they went in their whole hog, I mean, we're hearing a lot of reports that the Ukrainian Air Force is doing miracles. I guess there's somebody, they're called the, I can't remember, there's a MiG-25 pilot who supposedly has shot down a lot of advanced Russian jets. Well, that indicates to me that the Russians, perhaps on purpose, you know, didn't make a preemptive strike on the Ukrainian Air Force. And that they're not using their own air force to wreak mass destruction on Ukrainian ground troops and convoys and the like. But we don't know. We don't know what's going on. We don't know the truth of any of that. We don't even really know if the Ukrainian Air Force exists anymore. I mean, we're trusting what the Ukrainian government is telling us, and the Ukrainian government has every interest in convincing the West that they're putting up this heroic stand to try to encourage the NATO countries to jump in, to provide them with more arms, maybe directly intervene, maybe establish a no-fly zone over Ukraine to draw us in as much as we can. And astonishingly, almost all the Republicans are on board with this and supporting Joe Biden, this is a chance to unify the country behind a policy that goes against the national security interests of the United States, because, you know, it is not in the interests of the American people to get in a nuclear war with Russia for Ukrainian sovereignty. It's not in our interests to spend one American life for Ukrainian sovereignty. They're not in NATO, but we're confirming the worst accusations that Moscow was making about the Partnership for Peace, which was supposed to be an interim step to NATO. You know, Putin was accusing us of saying, look, just because Ukraine is not officially in NATO, nonetheless, we suspect you guys are going to treat them like they're a de facto member of NATO. And that is exactly what we're doing, or it seems to be that that's what we're doing. We haven't gone to nuclear war for Ukraine yet, but we're doing everything except that, almost everything except that. Fortunately, Biden hasn't sent any U.S. troops into Ukraine yet. We are sending arms into Ukraine in every way we can, as if, you know, why? You know, as if they're a NATO member state. And it's just very discouraging that the loyal opposition is not taking the position that Tucker Carlson takes every night, you know, which is the position that's fundamentally, I don't agree with Tucker that Russia is not a threat to the United States. I think he goes too far. Russia is a mortal threat to us. They could destroy our country in 30 minutes. But that makes it all the more compelling an argument,
yeah,
as to why the United States should not be involving itself in the situation with Ukraine. I think from previous shows, I've talked to so many different shows and done so many interviews now, I can't remember if on your show I made my case the way this issue should have been resolved, was that the Washington should have provided assurances to Russia that Ukraine was not going to become a member of NATO, and we weren't going to expand NATO any further eastward. And before all of this began, Russia offered what they call a peace treaty that had six demands. And I could go over all six of those demands and make a case as to how we could negotiate those points you know, not just caved everything Russia wanted, but we could negotiate those points and reach a compromise on all six of those points. And it would have been the beginning of hitting the reset button with Russia so that we could turn them into a strategic partner, or at least a neutral in the new Cold War with China. You know, because the most fundamental interest the United States has is not Ukrainian sovereignty, but it's the fact that we face this unprecedented military economic block, power block, in the Russia-China alliance. It's the most formidable, dangerous block we've ever faced, that the free world has ever faced in its history. And this block includes North Korea and Iran as well. Even one of the smallest members of this bloc, North Korea, is more dangerous to us than Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan were combined, because those countries did not have ICBMs armed with hydrogen bombs that could reach every American city. And that's what North Korea just by itself can do, but it's part of this power bloc. So what's the United States to do at the biggest foreign and defense policy objective we should have had and should still have is splitting that block, splitting that power block. The fact that they're allied together makes both of them more aggressive. And at this moment, when the West is economically and militarily weak, you know, it encourages them to engage in military aggression. But if we could persuade Russia to become a strategic partner, which is what Ronald Reagan wanted to do, and what George H. Bush wanted to do when the Cold War ended, and we were victorious in the Cold War, and we had wiser heads in Washington, that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to make sure that Russia would not come back as a revanchist nuclear superpower, you know, seeking to reestablish the USSR and take vengeance against the West, which is where we are today. That got lost sight of under the Clinton administration, and then by George W. Bush it got lost sight of when he decided to expand NATO to the East, which guaranteed that we were going to bring about the very circumstance that we face today, where the sides may be on the threshold of a global nuclear war over Ukraine. That's not in our interests to be there, to be putting the existence of our nation at risk for that. The smart chess move on the geopolitical chessboard would have been to get Russia on our side. And I think Russia wanted to come onto our side. Putin was waiting for Trump to hit the reset button because Trump and General Flynn planned to do that. You know, they understood that China was the bigger threat. And I think Putin understands that in the long run, China is a bigger threat to Russia than the United States for the West. And Putin was waiting for that move, that offer from Trump, but it never came. Trump was never politically in a position to do that, you know, because of these false charges that he was Putin's puppet and that the Russians got him elected, so he wasn't legitimately the president of the United States, and all of that nonsense that we went through for 4 years, all of it being proven false. And so that might have proven to be a fatal, mortal mistake in the West, that opportunity was lost. But the opportunity represented itself again. In a sense, the Ukrainian crisis could have been a golden opportunity when Moscow offered that peace treaty. It was an opportunity to sit down and negotiate our differences and change the fundamental relationship between the United States and Russia from one of confrontation to one of strategic partnership, or at least moving Russia into neutrality. And now that the Biden administration decided to follow the path of confrontation drew the line in the sand, and Putin crossed it, you know, it's obviously impossible at this point for us to hit a reset button and have a negotiation with Russia about becoming a strategic partner, because that would be clearly a sign of weakness, that in response to their conquest or attempted conquest of Ukraine, now we offer the olive branch.
Yeah, you can't
do
that.
That would just inspire aggression on the part of the Russians. They would have contempt for weakness. So, you know, we have to rebuild American credibility in the aftermath of all this, by rebuilding, making our electric grid and other critical infrastructures, hardening them against cyber and EMP attack. You know, we need to, I think we should deploy space-based missile defenses the way Ronald Reagan had wanted to try to render Russian and Chinese and North Korean and Iranian missiles obsolete, especially nuclear missiles. That would be something that would really hurt all of our adversaries and be far more impressive than the feather of economic sanctions. And we need to catch up with the Russians in the modernization of our nuclear forces, and especially tactical nuclear weapons, which they have at least a 10-to-1 advantage over us, NATO. You know, we've only got 180 tactical nuclear weapons. They've got 2,000 to 8,000, and ours are obsolete old gravity bombs.
Yeah, can you explain to our listeners the difference between the tactical nuclear weapons and strategic?
Sure. In theory, in military theory, the difference is that strategic weapons are weapons that are designed to reach the homeland of your adversary. So Russian strategic weapons are intercontinental weapons that can be delivered by ICBMs or sub-launch ballistic missiles or long-range strategic bombers. They typically have high yields so that they can destroy hardened missile silos, hardened command posts, and submarine pens, and blast, bomber bases. Tactical nuclear weapons are meant for battlefield use, typically in European NATO. And they can have a whole wide range of yields, typically much lower yields than strategic nuclear weapons, so that they can be used for practical battlefield applications, blasting bridges, blasting command posts, taking out an armored division or an armored battalion, blasting an aircraft carrier with a nuclear-armed torpedo, for example. A lot of people criticize the distinction between tactical and strategic because they point out that Russian tactical nuclear weapons are strategic weapons to everybody who neighbors Russia, because their homelands can be reached in Europe, in Asia, by these tactical nuclear weapons. But anyway, that's the difference. They have shorter ranges, they have lower yields, and there's a big technological difference between American and Russian tactical nuclear weapons because they're 30 years ahead of us, because of Russian cheating on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. They've got new generation tactical nuclear weapons that are ultra-low yield, that produce no radioactive fallout, that are small enough to be used as like air-to-air missiles. They use them out of artillery. They could use them from tanks for land forces, air forces, sea forces. They have specialized effects like EMP or X-rays or neutron radiation. We don't have any of that. Our tactical nuclear weapons tend to have higher yields and will produce radioactive fallout, and are not, there are many, many fewer of them, and they're not designed for making our land, sea, and air forces, basically nuclear armed, whereas the Russians are. It's like they've adopted, under President Eisenhower, he wanted to have a revolution, to revolutionize the warfighting capabilities of all U.S. services by having them incorporate nuclear arms of all kinds into all of the services. And we did that for a while under Eisenhower in the new look. And it's like the Russians, I mean, I'm not going to say they copied that, but that's a way of understanding it. They've always thought that way, and they've been following the new look forever. Well, Eisenhower called the new look, and have just gotten better and better at it, and developed better and better technologies.
Meanwhile, we've been worrying about windmills, et cetera.
Right, climate change.
Climate change, the existential threat. We have to take another really quick break, but I was going to add the quote from the top of your article from President Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt. The unforgivable crime is soft hitting. Do not hit at all if it can be avoided, but never hit softly. Never. And it's like, huh, we ought to make bumper stickers and just, you know, drive around Washington, D.C. with those on all the time.
It seems to be what our...
I would go for tattoos, but that just takes too much time. All right.
When we come back, let's talk about economic sanctions and how that's relevant.
That's the one that concerns me.
Great that's been. So our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Let me know you're here, 'cause my TV set just keeps it all from being clear. I want a reason for the way things have to be. I need a hand to help build up some kind of hope inside of me. And I
It's like every day, except for the...
What the heck
get
is
real
going
high
on?
Yeah, the stick your head out the door and just scream. That's about all we have left to us. Dr. Pry, before we move on to the sanctions part, I was looking at the graphic that you had given us, and I thought that the... You know, when you look at the tactical nuclear weapons, 180 on our side, in the NATO side, and Russia, 2,000 to 8,000. What could go wrong?
Right.
And Bill was reminding me that
category, we have no chemical weapons.
Yeah, I saw that too. No chemical, no biological.
No biological weapons. They have biological weapons. Maybe we have cyber weapons. We've never demonstrated that we have highly effective cyber weapons. The Russians definitely have cyber weapons. We know that. And of course, there's enormous disparities in the other categories of military power as well. 20,000 tanks on the Russian side versus about 1,100 for NATO, all of the NATO along the invasion route. I'm talking about Poland, Germany, France, Denmark, and the Benelux countries.
Yeah, that's Britain. A pretty thin line.
Yeah, they're outnumbered basically 20 to 1 in armor and about 2 to 1 in manpower. It could be much more than that because the Russians have more than a million men in the army. They can draw upon much larger reserves to mobilize, you know, if they wanted to take the time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But they're outnumbered in every category. NATO is outnumbered in every category. It's basically been hollowed out militarily by these socialist democrat governments, just like the Biden administration, that want to put all their focus on climate change and social welfare and despise the military. And they're globalists. This is getting maybe to the later part of our conversation, but, you know, they that look to They despise nationalism and patriotism in the military, and they look to supranational institutions like the United Nations, international law, and the U.S. global policemen to protect them.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, they've been hollowed out militarily over the years. I mean, in 1989, we had 5,000 tanks in Germany to protect NATO. The Obama administration took all of those out and went down to zero main battle tanks in NATO. And Trump started trying to put them back and reverse that. But today we only have 100 main battle tanks from the United States to join the small numbers of main battle tanks that exist in the other NATO-aligned countries. So Russia could... That's why we should not want this war to last long. Even if we're sympathetic to the Ukrainians and all the rest, you know, we don't want Russia to be provoked into invading NATO or basically invited in because of the weakness of the West, you know.
That brings up...
Hands-off policy would be much safer because they can go to the English Channel if they want to.
Sure, sure. And that brings up these economic sanctions we're, you know, holding so highly, which is so dangerous. Let's talk about that.
I couldn't believe a reporter asked the president, I mean, even the press, even the liberal mainstream press in the White House press office that always pitches him softballs, could hardly believe it, because one reporter asked them, you know, did a double take, and they said, you know, Mr. President, so you're going to impose economic sanctions in response to tanks and missiles and aircraft, you know, attacking Ukraine. Do you really consider that a proportionate and equivalent response? And Biden said yes.
Yes.
And they let him go, but they asked the question twice because I think they could hardly believe their ears. And that, my friends, is the moment, I think. You could actually go to that moment, future historians, about when did the United States cease to be a credible superpower. And you could probably go to that moment when the President of the United States compared economic sanctions as equivalent, you know, to the actual killing of people and the invasion of a country by tanks and aircraft and missiles. All of our allies listening to that, you know, what could they conclude from that? Is that what the United States is going to do to protect Japan and South Korea and the Philippines and the NATO alliance itself, that we'll sit back and levy economic sanctions to punish Putin or China for military aggression, and we will consider that an equivalent response, and our superpower responsibilities will have been fulfilled by such an act. You know, as I state in the article, I mean, I think all thinking people, at least I hoped until I've been following the press coverage recently, because one of the most appalling things to me is a lot of the reporters have kind of gone along with that now, and the debate is not whether economic sanctions are a serious response, you know, but what kind of economic sanctions, you know, is it increasing the economic sanctions to taking Russia out of SWIFT? Oh, that's going to really hurt them. That'll make a difference.
They'll pull out of Ukraine now. Yeah.
And I'm not arguing. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's what I'm saying is I look at that as just poking the bear one more time and just asking for a legitimate military response, and we're not prepared for that. And they
keep
piling this stuff on like it's going to back them down. You had on what we posted on the website here that economic sanctions are ineffectual and dangerous, and you went through some of the reasons on that, which I thought was really interesting. How in the past, economic sanctions never worked. And here we go again.
Yeah, not only have they never worked, but when our adversaries have found that that's all we're going to do, they become even more aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, economic sanctions didn't work against Russia when they annexed Crimea. And here they are now, back for more, invading Ukraine. You know, economic sanctions haven't worked against China, making cyber attacks against the United States, stealing our technology, making threats against Taiwan. By the way, now China is going to be having a big naval exercise in the South China Sea beginning this week.
Hmm.
So maybe that's the beginning of another front.
Exactly.
Economic sanctions did not stop North Korea from developing ICBMs, atomic bombs, hydrogen bombs, and missiles that can reach any city in the United States. You know, economic sanctions haven't stopped Iran from pursuing the atomic bomb. So now, even the optimists think that they're only 8 weeks away from being able to have an atomic bomb. I think they've had one for years now. So economic sanctions have got a history of failure. Economic sanctions in World War II against Japan were treated with such contempt that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, you know, as a consequence of that. So they're not only are they ineffective, but they're actually dangerous, provocative, because when you're dealing with military dictatorships that only respect military strength, to them, when economic sanctions look like a sign of cowardice, and cultural degeneracy and bankruptcy, and are tantamount to a surrender, tantamount to admission that we're not willing to fight and we're willing to surrender. Now, having said that, I'm not criticizing Biden for not fighting. I think he was. I don't want to fight for Ukraine. I don't think we should have gotten involved in the Ukrainian thing. But he did when he's and that's the ultimate idiocy about all of this thing, that he acts as if Ukraine is a vital strategic U.S. national interest, described it as such to the world, drew a line in the sand, and then when Russians called him on it, all he's going to do is respond with economic sanctions and this airlifting of weapons to the Ukrainians so that we're willing to fight to the last dead Ukrainian, okay?
Yeah.
But
I guess that's why they put the line in the sand. They just hope for a high tide.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just you look at all this and it doesn't go anywhere good. Your article does an excellent job of laying that out. And tell me this, besides the fact that it's on our site, is it called The Doom of NATO? Is that how the article was published?
The Doom of NATO, ? Newsmax has published it in pieces.
Okay.
And it isn't called, and that's behind a paywall, a platinum paywall.
Oh, look what you get here. You get
Newsmax
the free article.
Platinum, which is one of the reasons I sent the whole thing to you.
Okay, I appreciate that. We're going to be back for the second hour with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. In the meantime, you can go to our website and read that article. It is
wethepeopleradio.us.
Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Mm-hmm. Well, see him if you're looking for a tractor, a mower, tractor implements, repairs, parts. They do it all up there. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Got to put the 530 before it. I called somebody without using the area code the other day, and I got Sweden.
Oh, yeah, that's probably not good.
Ruh-roh.
Yeah.
Yeah, so be careful with that. Our guest this show is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and we thought it was really important to have him on during this because he has spoken with us so many times about the threat of this whole thing. and EMP and all that. And I've got to tell you, he's a prolific writer. He's fun to talk to, too, but he's a prolific writer. There is a tremendous amount of information out there. And if all you do is read all the things we've posted that he's given us to put on all the different shows, every program on our site has articles, links, and all those things about the guest. And it also has the commercial-free archives. They are free to access. You can send them. You can burn them on CDs and sell them at a fundraiser. We don't care. We do this show as basically a service to the public to educate people. So we're not copyrighted. We're not going to come after you or sue you or whatever. We want the information to get out there. So be a blabber.
Yeah, spread the news.
Be a blabber.
One of the things that we posted on the site today was a map of a possible EMP scenario. If Russia were to detonate an EMP over Belgium, it shows the area that would be knocked out. I mean, basically all your electronics would be neutralized, and it's worth a look because it basically is going to take out everything from the United Kingdom all the way to Austria and the Czech Republic, Germany, France. They're all down. So there goes NATO. One shot. So this is really a serious situation here, and we've been talking about economic sanctions and how ineffective they are and how dangerous they are. I'd like to pick that back up again.
Yeah, they're effective in one dimension.
Yes.
Which is why they're used so often. Because they've become a tool by which Western elites who are frightened of doing anything serious can try to mislead the public and the press into thinking that they're taking serious action.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so disappointing to see it actually working again. You know, that they got their marching orders, the press has got its marching orders from the Biden White House that that economic sanctions are tough measures and they're supposed to be equivalent to the use of military force against Ukraine. Even the bootlicking reporters in the White House press room were aghast initially at that, but they fell in line after questioning the president, doubting that, you know, for a moment. But that's what the economic sanctions are really all about. The elites in Washington and in the Western democracies throughout the world have got to know that economic sanctions against Russia, China, North Korea, Iran are a feather. You know, that they have been inconsequential. You know, it's a disinformation, a deception campaign, a CYA exercise, so that they don't have to take risks in actually providing for national security. And they don't know what to do. They don't know what to do. So it makes them look tough. It makes it look like they're doing something.
Well, I think at some point, I mean, early on, when you're not talking about a shooting war, economic sanctions do have an impact on an adversary. But when you're this far down the road and you're going to get tough and lay economic sanctions on Russia, I really believe that is just creating a very dangerous scenario for everybody, especially with this guy. I question his stability with this whole move anyway, but now we're going to just keep poking at him and just to see what's going to happen, I think. It's crazy.
Another dimension of economic sanctions that almost never gets discussed is the price that we, the American people, have to pay for these economic sanctions.
I think a
good case can be made that if you look at the net effect of economic sanctions, that we suffer more than anybody from these economic sanctions. And I invite you to do a little experiment and take a look at the dollars, the money in your wallet sometime. And you may notice that that we have these new our money is different from younger people may not notice it, but it used to be that there was only two colors in our money, you know, there was green and kind of off-white. But now there are colors mixed into the fibers that our dollars are made of, a new kind of money. And why is that? Why did we change the look of our money? Well, we did that because of the economic sanctions against North Korea. People have wondered, gee, I mean, the North Koreans are starving to death. We've employed all these economic sanctions, supposedly the most severe economic sanctions in the world in history over and over again. So how come North Korea keeps going on and building atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs, bigger and better missiles? Well, that's because North Korea is the world's leading counterfeiter of American money. They got so good at counterfeiting our money that we couldn't tell the difference anymore. And they flooded the world with at least hundreds of millions, maybe billions of dollars in counterfeit American bills. And that was starting to have some serious economic implications. So we changed the look of our money in an effort to defeat the North Korean counterfeiting efforts. But the federal government, you know, has not come clean with the American people or not explained that as vociferously as it should. But that's just one example of the kind of hidden price that we end up paying for these economic sanctions. You know, the bad guys always find ways around them, and oftentimes those ways, the way they find around it hurts us more than the sanctions hurt them.
Well, and I think we're going to see that with the whole oil crisis. Now that we're importing a lot of our oil from Russia.
Yeah, that's the least of our worries.
Yeah.
That's another thing, you know, they make it sound like, well, the price we're going to pay is a little more at the pump. Let's hope the price we don't pay is a cyber attack.
Yeah.
That blasts out the national grid.
Exactly.
I mean, that could really happen. They, after the last confrontation over Ukraine, it was just weeks after that was resolved. That happened in April of 2021. In March 2021, just weeks later, they hacked the Colonial Pipeline as a demonstration of what they could do. And the purpose in hacking the Colonial Pipeline wasn't to cost us more gas at the pump. It did, but the main thing was to demonstrate that they could shut down the oil supply and petroleum supply, provided about half of our gasoline and other petroleum products to our East Coast military bases, you know, which we rely upon to project power to protect NATO or to fight on behalf of Ukraine if we wanted to do that. And let's hope we don't end up doing that. You know, my criticism of sanctions isn't because I want Biden to do more militarily. You know, again, reiterating, you know, my position on this is that we shouldn't have gotten involved in the first place in a confrontational way. But this could have been resolved diplomatically. You know, and the object should have been to use the dispute over Ukraine as an opportunity to hit the reset button in our relations with Russia. You know, we could have done that, and that would have probably done more to protect Ukrainian sovereignty than all of this saber rattling and that we've been doing on our side. These hollow threats that we've been making. I'm so disappointed in the Republican Party. I mean, they're supposed to be the loyal opposition. What an opportunity for them, especially as we're heading toward midterm elections, to draw a line, you know, between the Republicans being a nationalist party to look out for U.S. national interests, our national security interests, versus the Democrats who are globalists who don't care about U.S. national security interests. They're willing to sacrifice our national interests on behalf of globalism, you know, which includes things like going to the defense of the sovereignty of any country, you know, even if it doesn't have American national security interests involved, so that we're the global policemen. We always pay the price in blood and treasure, even if it doesn't mean our interests are advanced. In fact, they like it better if we don't have an interest that's being advanced, and we're working against our own interests, as we are in Ukraine, for example. Because, I guess because in their minds that makes us morally pure. They really hate the kind of idea of nationalism. And ultimately, you know, what they want is a one-world global order run by supranational institutions like the United Nations, international law, and using the U.S. Underwrites all of it with our blood and treasure as the global policeman. But it doesn't advance our national interests. They would argue that it does, but someone looking at it rationally and taking any of the wars that we've been fighting, you know, in recent decades, it's very hard to make a case how these involvements, for example, in the Middle East or in what we're doing now in Ukraine, serve American national interests, whether it's national security or economic interests or anything else. But that's what the Republicans should be doing, is pointing this, demanding that President Biden explain what U.S. national security interests, what U.S. interests are at stake here, that you're putting us in danger, you know, that you've brought us possibly to the verge of a nuclear war over Ukraine. Why is that justified? Why are you doing that, sir? You know? And if this thing goes, arguably, if this thing goes south for the Russians, or even if it doesn't, you know, they are perfectly capable, the press and the Biden administration, of living in this kind of fantasy world. Let's suppose Ukraine falls tomorrow, you know. They're already trying to make this narrative about, oh, the Russians got bogged down. They're bogged down, all right? So if Ukraine falls tomorrow, I'm sure that there will be the left-wing mainstream media will probably be willing to argue that, oh, look, it took longer for Ukraine to fall than we thought it would. And therefore, Joe Biden made the Russians pay a price in blood and treasure, okay? And so he was successful in Ukraine. And because he was successful in Ukraine, that proves that we don't need the big defense budgets. NATO doesn't need bigger defense budgets. The United States doesn't need bigger defense budgets. We can go along on our merry way, denuclearizing, reducing the size of our nuclear forces, because Biden was right in Ukraine. And they'll probably argue that. I mean, that's
terrifying.
Live in that. Try to get us to believe this fantasy, all right, of what has got to be one of the greatest strategic and diplomatic failures in U.S. history. You know, but nobody is being critical of the administration except Tucker Carlson and a handful of others.
Well, and as soon as you do that, you're a puppet of Russia, blah, blah, blah.
Right,
And the left hasn't even figured out that the whole Russia thing was a hoax yet. You know, several books written about it, lots of good information out there, but they kind of ramped this up right about the time that some of that information was coming out. And for anybody who hasn't seen the movie Wag the Dog, you're really missing out, because that was kind of like a sneak preview on a little bit of this. We are going to come right back. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You can find everything about our program, including the commercial-free archive, after this airs, later this afternoon, at wethepeopleradio.us.
Ow! Who said I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want. Listen to me, Little Red Riding Hood.
When it's time for the fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. We will all go together when we go. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes Uranus, We will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, we all will go together when we go.
I figured we needed to lighten the mood. I was going to go for some kind of a Russian bear song, but all I had was Little Red Riding Hood.
Well, that's certainly the left's perspective of nuclear weapons.
Yes, actually, that's true.
Used. And that's why they're so reckless, because they have convinced themselves that Russia and China, they wouldn't use nuclear weapons. In fact, when you read the press reports about the Russian strategic exercises, the nuclear forces exercises, or Putin putting his nuclear forces on higher alert, I guarantee you they'll characterize that as bluster and nuclear saber rattling, okay? Because they don't understand that the Russians don't agree with us that the use of nuclear weapons is the end of the world. They do believe you could fight and win a nuclear war, and they're right about that. But our own elites, are so anti-nuclear and are so incapable of understanding the other side's strategic culture, history, and military doctrine.
Well, they've already said they're not afraid to be
the way we do.
Yeah, they're not afraid to be a first strike. I mean, they've said that we don't. We're all, our belief is we'll never be the first strike country, but Russia will. They got no problem if there's an advantage, but we don't seem to believe that.
Right, and in fact, one of the things I discuss in my article, and this is one of the supreme ironies, because President Biden and his administration are the most anti-nuclear administration we've ever had in history, where he has brought many anti-nuclear activists into his administration. And we also have a Congress. The Democrat Party has never been more anti-nuclear. You know, where we have high-ranking people, you know, including Adam Smith, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, very anti-nuclear, talking about banning U.S. ICBMs unilaterally, getting rid of U.S. strategic bombers. Just this past summer, when Biden met with Putin, Biden insisted they signed a joint statement about stating that a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. Now, the Russians don't believe that, but they're happy to encourage that attitude in the West because they know it strengthens the anti-nuclear activists, both in and out of government, and further weakens us. And now, under the nuclear posture review, you know, Biden has been very seriously considered a no-first-use pledge. That is to say that the United States will never use nuclear weapons first. And that was considered so seriously, this is State Department secretly issued a query, an inquiry, of all of our allies to find out, well, what do you think? What if the United States issues a no-first-use pledge, how do you feel about that? And our allies were aghast at the possibility that the U.S. nuclear umbrella would no longer be there to protect them. When you put some of these things together with this use of economic sanctions, the weak feather of economic sanctions to oppose Russian military force, I mean, this guy in 1 year is just destroying American credibility in so many different ways from so many different directions. But it's a supreme irony that the Biden's defense of NATO is entirely based on the nuclear deterrent at this moment. Biden has promised that America is not going to get militarily involved in Ukraine. You know, we're not going to send any troops to fight for Ukraine, and I pray to God he stands by that. And the war fever that the press is building up, and that is the fans of that war fever that are being fanned from the White House, don't end up pushing Biden into doing what he doesn't want to do, put U.S. forces into the fight. I mean, some members of Congress have actually used the phrase, we should jump into Ukraine, all right, and get involved there. All of this reporting about the United States and NATO allies sending thousands of troops into Eastern Europe to protect the NATO border against Russia. You know, when you add up all those troops, it's about 10,000 to 15,000 troops. It's a very thin line. That is not a serious defense. It includes a very few main battle tanks. There's maybe a couple dozen jet fighters that have been forward deployed. It's nothing. It's nothing. The Russians could roll right over that if they decided to invade NATO. The whole reason for doing it is that if Americans and the NATO allies get killed as the Russians invade, if the Russians invade, it could trigger nuclear first strike by the United States, you know, which has been part of our strategic planning for years, because we can't protect NATO with conventional forces alone, or we may not be able to protect them. Certainly we can't protect them now, when we were much stronger during the Cold War. There were serious doubts about whether we could protect them, and so we've always planned on using tactical nuclear weapons to compensate for the superiority that Russia has on the ground and in the air in terms of conventional forces. So basically, anti-nuclear Joe Biden, who's considering ratcheting down and reducing our nuclear deterrent to dangerously low levels, is relying right now on the nuclear tripwire to defend NATO.
Well, in your article, you had mentioned that we had actually, via, I think, Great Britain, moved a couple of our strategic bombers into Poland.
Yes.
Never been done before, and don't think Putin doesn't know that. And to me, again, that just looks like another threat that he could act upon.
These people are so irresponsible, you know? They're so irresponsible. They're so convinced that they can play with nuclear fire and that, oh, the Russians will be too afraid of us. Nobody's going to use nuclear weapons, you know?
Right.
This is the possibility of a nuclear war happening through miscalculation or accident in a crisis like this is very, very high.
Sure.
I mean, we had a situation like this back in 1983 when we had much smarter people at the helm in Washington, you know, during the NATO theater nuclear exercise called Able Archer 83. And the Russians became convinced that we were getting ready to strike them. And they almost launched a preemptive strike. And the only reason that didn't happen is because the exercise ended before, you know, hours before the time they planned to actually do it. And so the world was spared from a nuclear holocaust in 1983 that would have happened by miscalculation.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly this kind of playing with nuclear fire, you know, it's just like a child playing with a .45 automatic, you know, that's loaded and the hammer is cocked. That's what how I feel, you know, the world is, the condition of our circumstances are right now. You know, because these people that we've got in the White House and in the Pentagon with General Miley, you know, are the least competent people we've ever had before. I mean, these people are really not good at their jobs.
Mm-mm.
No.
As we could see in Afghanistan, as we could see during the presidential transition when General Miley called the chief of the general staff of China to assure him that the United States was not planning to launch a nuclear surprise attack.
Yeah.
You know.
I'm sure he didn't think that was ever getting out.
And now this. I can't help but wonder, you know, that maybe General Miley, how did we get into this? You know, maybe General Miley, I'm just speculating. I don't have any knowledge of this, but I can imagine after the embarrassment of Afghanistan, you know, that maybe Miley has told Biden that they can have a little crisis with Russia and that Miley and the Joint Chiefs are smart enough to contain it so it won't get out of hand and turn into a big war.
Oh, my gosh, that's even scarier than what we're looking at.
I can believe it, you know, that
yeah.
This is maybe he got the White House, what can we do? We're down in the polls. You know, it looks like we're going to lose the midterms. Everybody's unhappy with our domestic policies. We need something that's going to rally the country behind the president, which is another reason I have such contempt for these Republicans that are rallying behind the president and are not challenging the wisdom of what he's doing in Ukraine. This is their opportunity to actually show they're different than the Democrats and responsible, unlike the irresponsible Democrats that are putting the country, the national existence of the country, and the millions of American lives at risk for a nation where we have no vital interests at stake.
And do you think it's just because they don't want to look like, you know, in a time of crisis that they're being disloyal?
I think that all politicians, Republican or Democrat, with very few exceptions, okay, are pretty contemptible people. First, I think that most, having worked on the Hill and worked with, now, the members of Congress I personally have worked with were some of the best, most competent people I've ever known. And unfortunately, they would fall with W.E.B. Du Bois, described every system as having the talented 10, that like 10% of the people do 90% of the work, okay?
Sure.
And I think that that's true in Congress as an institution, too. But that talented 10% tends to get blown out because they do controversial things, and they won't go along with stupidity.
Yeah, and guys so, like Adam Schiff stay there forever?
Then they stay there forever, okay? The good guys I'm talking about, I'm going to give a shout-out to Kurt Weldon, who had been the vice chairman of the House Armed Services Committee and the House Homeland Security Committee, the only person ever to hold the position for both of those things. And had he been listened to back in the Clinton and George W. Bush years, we wouldn't have expanded NATO, and we would have been a strategic partner with Russia already. But he eventually got blown out. And Roscoe Bartlett, you know, who is one of the congressmen from Maryland, you know, who had been, if this country ever gets protected from EMP and cyber warfare, he and Kurt Weldon together will be chiefly responsible for that. And I would add Representative Jim Saxton, who anticipated that there was going to be something like 9/11 before it happened, and had and was pushing and pushing. All of those guys are no longer in the system, you know, because they have courage and because they did the right thing when everybody else was wrong. And that's the ultimate crime in Washington, to be right when everybody else was wrong. You know, that's the way of getting your career killed. So most of these politicians, frankly, there's something wrong with them. You know, most of them are not deep thinkers. They don't read. They don't know history. They're not really good at the jobs. They're good with people, okay? But they're not really good at what they're supposed to be doing in terms of national security and the rest. And they have a there's a profound narcissism in these people, where they want everybody to love them, you know. And I think the Republicans just can't resist the opportunity to get good press from the left-wing media at this moment. You know, their press officers are saying, oh, wow, if we get behind Biden, you know, Republicans are usually associated with being a hawkish party, a pro-military party, the pro-war party, and in this case, when a Democrat, you know, seems to be pushing for war and is taking a hawkish position, and there's all this excitement over Ukraine, here's an opportunity to get good press and go on to CNN and MSNBC and get good press from these places that are normally ready to just spit all over Republicans, you know. And they just can't resist that. You know, I think that that's the main part. That's probably a major factor in it. You know, in addition to the fact that people just, you know, a lot of Republicans are just so confused, you know, national security, the idea of national security, with being willing to support any war that comes along. You know, any war that comes along, you have to support it because that makes you look strong on national security, which is really simple-minded.
Well, I also noticed that one of the big differences, you know, since we have, 500 and 35 people in Congress, and we see six on television, or maybe seven, and the same ones over and over and over. And you'll notice with some of these people that, you know, we kind of all love to hate, they live there. They live in Washington. They don't typically live in their district. And that's a big game changer. When you just move back there and you kind of forget about the people at home and everything is about the Washington, D.C., you know, bubble and the overlords there, I think it's just, I don't know, we've talked about that a million times on the show. I just am not sure that you can escape the, you know, the vortex that sucks you in.
So. Yeah, it's what the founders, it's one of the things the founders feared, you know, writing the Federalist, it was one of the main concerns in the Federalist Papers, that if you established a federal government, that it could become a new Rome, you know, and all the power would be concentrated in this new Rome, and we'd have a new aristocracy over us. And that's basically what we've got. And these people, and it's not just egotism and stuff, I shouldn't understate the ties that members of Congress and their staffs have to the military-industrial complex, and, you know.
Well, and then we haven't even gotten into the bureaucracy that is the permanent ruling class. And most of the time, they're relatively untouchable. I mean, there's not a whole lot. They might get moved from one position to another, but even if they are found to have done bad things, I remember when those Dirty Diana and the other one with the VA, and they walked away with $750,000, and they didn't have to pay it back, and they didn't get fired.
Yeah, they got promoted.
Yeah, and so it's like, oh my God,
Dr. Fauci is the poster child.
Oh yeah, that's true. Let's not forget the king rat. We've take a really quick break on that note, and we will be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
You know, the last line in your article, Dr. Pry, is in the military contest between Western globalism and Russian and Chinese nationalism, nationalism wins. And that's kind of frightening because there we are.
Yeah, and that's why people like Trump. That's why they liked him, because people want to be proud of their country. They don't want to be part of a blob. And I
well, that's exactly right. And
I kind of wonder how those EU folks are doing now, you know?
That's how far away we are from safety, you know?
Yep.
Because I think one of the hardest things we've got to do to achieve national security, you know, is not just modernize our nuclear forces and protect ourselves from EMP and cyber warfare and deploy space-based missile defense. Those technological solutions are relatively easy compared to reforming the way we think about our national security and foreign and defense policy. Can we re-educate? Will President Trump or whoever becomes the next president, if we have free elections in this country ever again, fair elections ever again, and we get a conservative nationalist president, will he be able to re-educate the Department of Defense and the Defense Department to think in terms of U.S. national interests? Or have we been mired in globalism? And we have been mired in it, in our foreign policy. I in the article I say in the Pope since 1945, but it really goes back to Woodrow Wilson in 1918, Wilsonian idealism and his 14 points. and the League of Nations and all that. That has dominated, that approach has dominated our foreign and defense policy for many decades. You know, and it's this pie-in-the-sky idealism that thinks that we can evolve beyond the nation state and run the world through world courts and the United Nations and international law, with the United States paying the price for all that.
Right.
The United States
right.
being the global policeman. You see, the globalists don't care if we sacrifice the United States, its blood and treasure, and even its existence. If we can achieve globalism, it'll be worth it. That's one of the things people don't, American people don't understand, because the elites don't tell them that. They'll appeal to our patriotism to go and fight in Ukraine, you know, and not explain that, well, we're fulfilling a globalist ideal here, and it doesn't really, it doesn't, American national interests don't really matter here. There's a higher cause, which is globalism. That they're after, and we have got to change that, because throughout history, until the aftermath of World War One, I mean, real politics is the way the relations between states have always been governed: balance of power, peace through strength, national interests coldly and coolly calculated. What is your national interest, and then acting on that specific, quote-unquote, selfish national interest.
Sure, balance,
you know,
of trade,
not
all
on,
that.
Being the world policeman and being there for countries all over the world. And I'm not, and this may sound like an exaggeration to you, I promise you it is not. This Ukrainian situation is setting, suppose we get past this, hopefully we'll get past this, pray God we do, this crisis with Ukraine. Ukraine is not the only Partnership for Peace nation. You know, what happens with Kazakhstan and Tajikistan and Uzbekistan? They're all Partnership for Peace nations. You know, in the same status that Ukraine was in, you know, in the intermediate step to becoming NATO members, they're all in Central Asia. Are we going to go to the brink now if Russia decides to go after them? And it will go after them, since Putin's goal is to reconstitute the territory of the Tsarist Empire and of the USSR. And so we're going to have to play this game of Russian nuclear roulette again and again and again until it fails, without our own national interests being at stake. You know, I fear so, the way this is going and the way the Republicans have failed, you know, to challenge the administration on this. You know, they should be objecting to this in the strongest possible terms. You know.
Do they get painted as warmongers if they do that?
How can it be painted as a warmonger?
I don't know. It just seems like everything you try to do that's the right thing.
I'm asking the Republicans
comes out upside down.
The United States getting involved in a war for Ukraine.
Well, yeah, no,
say,
it makes no sense.
We should stay out of it. This is not our business.
Yeah.
Even if we couldn't have, and maybe it was, maybe we couldn't have achieved a diplomatic settlement with Russia. It may well be, and, you know, Brett Hume, I have a lot of respect for him, you know, said, you know, even if we had promised to keep Ukraine out of NATO, he thinks it's inevitable. And maybe he's right. He may well be right, you know, because that Russia's national interests are reconstituting the Tsarist Empire, including you.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
And so they have real vital national interests, unlike us. They have vital national interests in Ukraine, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, all these territories. So it may well be that this was inevitable, that Russia's invasion and annexation of Ukraine is inevitable, and that it's going to be inevitable that they're going to invade and annex all these other countries as well. Does that mean that the United States has a vital national interest in stepping in and opposing Russia and possibly getting involved in a nuclear war? No, it doesn't. Because if you have a realist point of view, if you look at this from the perspective of real politics, those areas are Russia's natural sphere of influence.
Right.
These countries that are around its border and where it has these vital interests. You know what? we may have talked in the show in the past about Clemens von Metternich and, you know, the way foreign policy used to be conducted under realpolitik. Clemens von Metternich didn't invent it, but a lot of the ideas, were articulated, formalized. Metternich, in the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars, he was a brilliant statesman from what used to be, it was the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the time. And when Napoleon was defeated, nations of Europe got together. He organized them in what was called the Concert of Europe. They got together and said, how can we avoid another Napoleonic War, which was basically a world war? How can we avoid having that repeat in Europe? And he said, well, you know, the great powers have to respect the interests of the other great powers and recognize that they have spheres of influence, you know, and we're going to stay out of their sphere and recognize that they have, you know, where their national interests are, you know, we're going to let them, even if we don't like those governments and we don't agree with those governments and we don't like what they're doing in their sphere of influence, that's their backyard, and we're going to respect their right to do whatever they want in their own backyard. And they're going to return that reciprocity to us, you know, and they're going to respect our sphere of influence and stay out of our backyard. And this way, maybe everybody can get along and we can avoid another Napoleonic War, all right? And that worked until 1914, when the system broke down and finally failed. And that's one of the reasons Wilsonian idealism and the globalist approach came up, because people blamed nationalism for World War One. Whole concept of realpolitik is that realpolitik failed. You know, we've got to go to this new approach to providing for national security and a supranational internationalist order, the League of Nations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Metternich failed after a century, okay? He did a heck of a lot better than Woodrow Wilson did. You know, we went from World War One to World War Two and a generation, right? And then we went immediately from World War II to the Cold War, and things have not been on a happy trend for relations between countries. It looks like we're headed for a nuclear World War III, maybe tomorrow, the way things are going, and we can thank globalism for that, because the United States hasn't been following its selfish national interests. And that's going to be the hardest thing for our political elites to wrap their minds around.
Sure.
I think, you know, we have President Trump maybe in the pipeline again, but that approach put America first, you know, that Ronald Reagan, we had a president there that did it, but we really need to change the worldview in Washington. It can't be just one president. You know, the bureaucracy has got to start thinking that way, and I'm not sure we're able to do it.
Yeah, well, if you look at where we are now with Russia and where Russia's position is in the world, it's almost a no win for him at this point. He can take over and win this war, but where does that leave him? And if he's losing this war, where does that leave him? I mean, he's going to strike. He doesn't have really much of a choice. He's put himself kind of in a box, hasn't he?
I know Washington would like us to think of that, you know, because that's how Biden has got a victory. He's put Russia into the box and everything. I think just the opposite is true, really. I think that first of all, if the Russians are defeated in Ukraine, which seems unlikely, but if they are defeated, it's not going to be because of the trickle of arms. It's not going to be because of the sanctions or the trickle of arms that have been provided by NATO to Ukraine. You know, if Russia is defeated, it's going to be because Ukraine has 1,500 tanks, you know, which is more tanks than Poland, Germany, France, the United Kingdom, and the Benelux countries have combined, okay? And it's going to be because the Ukrainian general staff and their soldiers were trained by Russia. And they know how the Russians fight, and they fight the same way that the Russians fight.
Mm-hmm.
So NATO shouldn't be, if Russia is defeated in Ukraine, NATO shouldn't be puffing out its chest and pretending that this means that NATO can take on Russia.
But where would that leave Putin?
That the Russians can take on themselves, basically.
Right.
But I don't think this is headed toward a Ukrainian victory.
No, I don't either.
I think that the person that's in a box right now is the United States. I think our credibility as a superpower is in the toilet because of what Biden did by staking our credibility on the idea that he could deter Russia from invading Ukraine. And now this weak response that he's got in reaction to that, Russia will be happy. I mean, the casualties, they paid in World War II, they paid 20 to 30 million dead to conquer Ukraine and the Warsaw Pact areas. Much of that is, many of those deaths and casualties happened in Ukraine itself, where the heaviest fighting was happening. They call it the Bloodlands. And they considered Russians celebrate that victory
right.
in World War II. It's the Great Patriotic Father's War. It looks to me like they're buying Ukraine really on the cheap in terms of casualties. I think Putin will be very happy if he prevails, as I think he will, because this was going to be the toughest nut to crack in terms of reconstituting.
And where do you think if he walks away with a victory in Ukraine, where does that leave Putin? Does he continue his march?
The next step for me, if I was Putin, would probably be Kazakhstan. It's the next biggest chunk of territory, another enormous country. It's got a much smaller population. It has no military because it's so afraid of being reoccupied by Russia. In fact, Putin actually did take over Kazakhstan before he went into Ukraine. They did a police action because allegedly there was an uprising in Kazakhstan, an Islamic uprising, according to the Russians, that they had to put down. And they demonstrated the ability to just walk in and take over Kazakhstan basically in a couple of days. And then they withdrew, supposedly withdrew. And I think part of the reason they were doing that was to warn us that, yeah, we're willing to invade another country and that they have the resolve to do it. So I think that Putin will probably go and continue his dream of reconstituting the former USSR, the territories of the former USSR.
Mm-hmm.
I'm most worried about the Baltic states, because they're indefensible to us. Even using, according to RAND Corporation, even if we try to use tactical nuclear weapons, we can't defend the Baltic states. And they're part of NATO.
See, that's the problem.
Yeah. And so that will definitely, bring us, to the brink again if he does that. So that's the...
Well, we're going to...
That's where we'll be left.
We're going to, of course, force you to be our hostage again because I don't see any of this going away soon. So we appreciate you sending us articles and things, and I'll continue to post them. Our guest this last couple of hours has been Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and he's on our show enough that he has his own tab at the top of the page. You could just go on there and click and listen to all the different shows that we've done with him. I thought, well, he should have his own tab. That'd be awesome. So thank you so much for that, and we will chat with everybody next week. We're talking about technocracy with Patrick Wood. You're going to love it. You're listening to We the People. Find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
What is it good for?
Nothing.
What is it?